Let's think for a second. If there was a great commandment in Australia in the 21st century, what do you think it would be? Person off the street, a person that's in your neighbourhood, person at work, mostly people who don't go to church, people who don't know the Bible very well, what would the greatest commandment be, do you think? Well, according to research... No, I didn't. Have fun? Close. according to research, it's not the golden rule anymore. You know, do unto others as you would have others do unto you. But it's related. It's thou shalt not judge. You shall not judge, or else others will judge you. In a song, pop song by Julia Michael, some of you might have heard it, it's about 12 months old now, she confesses she has issues. That's the name of the song. But listen to what she says about it. I'm jealous. I'm overzealous. When I'm down, I get real down. When I'm high, I don't come down. I get angry, baby. Believe me, you are very fortunate that I'm not singing this to you, by the way. I could love you just like that, and I could leave you just this fast, I guess, for it to rhyme. Anyone kind of know the rest of it? What's the chorus? Come on, some of you guys over there, you know it. Okay, all right. You don't judge me. Close. You don't judge me, because if you did, baby, I would judge you too. No, you don't judge me, because if you did, baby, I would... Lots of babies in there, isn't there? I would judge you too, because I got issues, but you got them too. In this song, a concern, what's the thing that is to be worked out? Well, it's not the issues that's being worked out, is it? The song is really saying, just make darn sure that you're not judging me, because I know you got issues and I would judge you. It's not working out the problems or the issues. It's judgment that's being condemned here. Judgment, the act of judging another person's actions by, you know, some sort of standard or some sort of code of behavior, that's just not in today. If you want to maintain a relationship with that person, if you want to maintain a relationship with anyone under the age of 40, you cannot be seen to be judgmental. You see, what used to be polite, right? Not saying these sorts of things out in public, it's actually become a moral matter. It's a matter of right and wrong that you don't judge. So much so, last year, in research conducted here, right here in Australia, among the top barriers to becoming Christian for non-Christians, there are things like church abuse and the perceived hypocrisy in the church there. But right up there is the idea that Christians are judgmental as well. In terms of issues, after homosexuality, after all, 2017 was our year of the gay marriage debate, which was huge. After that, the biggest issue that keeps people from exploring Christianity, it's the issue of the Bible's teaching on God's final judgment and the reality of hell. We really don't like this idea of someone who judges, someone who calls us to account by some sort of external standard. I mean, we don't even like when people point out our own inconsistencies with our own internal standard. We don't like the idea of a God who is judge. Even on Sundays, the research says the trend in churches increasingly is for Jesus to be portrayed as someone who's more like a coach, a psychologist, a spiritual counselor, his lordship, and less as the judge of the universe. Folks, for our purpose in this term in the God Story, Our Story series has been to trace the big story of God's dealings with his people. Along the way, we've been seeing important things, important discoveries in regards to God's character, his power, his goodness, his order in creation. We saw that a few weeks ago. And we've already caught a glimpse of his sense of justice, but also his grace when we looked at the fall. But one other really important reason for knowing the story of God is that he actually shows us his method or his pattern of relating to his people. Not only will we see that a just God judges sin and evil, but we're actually going to see this week that the way God advances his purposes to save his people is actually through judgment. It's actually really, really important that he judges. And these are patterns that the Bible, the New Testament particularly, assumes are normal. But if we don't know it, if we don't understand it, if we reject it, we won't actually understand the Bible. And worse still, we'll invent a God who doesn't judge. A God who is made in our own image. A God of our own making. So, this week, we're in the book of Exodus, the second book of the Bible. And we saw, gave it away there, we saw last week that God makes these promises and this covenant that he establishes when he promises Abraham three things. Those of you who are fast, what are those three things? The acronym is LOB, L-O-B. What's L stand for? Land, yep, the promised land of Canaan. O is for offspring, that's right. And what's B stand for? Blessing, land, offspring, blessings, that's right. And these have begun to be fulfilled by the beginning of Exodus. Abraham's descendants, they're a very large nation. Now, that's all great, but what about the promise of a land? Because as Evelyn shared with us at the beginning of that Bible reading, Israel is stuck. Abraham's children, his great-great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren, as many as they are, they're stuck in Egypt as slaves of the Pharaoh, making bricks, and in fact, being made to make bricks with our straw. Sure, they're numerous as a nation, but they have no prospect of getting out of Egypt, let alone kind of being their own people in the land that they're being promised. They're oppressed. They're in need of rescue. And so we see God rescues them and saves them, but in a peculiar way. He rescues and saves them through judgment on the nation of Egypt, a pattern that we're going to see throughout the rest of God's story. The template of salvation, point one on your outline there, it includes a few elements we've already seen. In reading, in our reading in Exodus 6, 5 and 6, Moses has there talked about a few things. Did you hear how he talks about that special word again, covenant? How God remembers his promises and covenants with Abraham, their ancestor. Let me read it again. Keep your Bibles open. This is the most extensive time we're going to spend in one particular passage. Chapter 6, verse 2. So Moses had a big whinge to the Lord, to Yahweh, about how none of the things that he was supposed to be able to do is happening, that Pharaoh is actually kind of really, really upset with the people of Israel. Well, God says this to Moses, I am Yahweh. I appear to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob as God Almighty. But by my name, Yahweh, I did not make myself fully known to them. That should already kind of put Moses in his place, shouldn't it? I also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, where they resided as foreigners. Moreover, I have heard the groaning of the Israelites whom the Egyptians are enslaving, and I have remembered my covenant. When God stirs to action, you see here that the basis of his actions are actually tied to this idea of this covenant, this gracious relationship that he has tied himself in. That the promises made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are the reason why God has heard his people and remembered his covenant. Now, that last bit there, it's not that God forgot the covenant all of a sudden, like he's been like on a very, very long kind of, afternoon doze, and he's only suddenly woken up and everything had not gone the way he had intended. Remembering the covenant is actually more like this. If we as a nation, if Australia was ever attacked, right, what would Malcolm do? Malcolm Turnbull, our Prime Minister, would pick up the phone. He'd talk to Donald. All right, he would invoke the ANZUS Treaty, and the 7th and the 9th and the 11th and the 20th Fleet or whatever there is out there would come racing to Australia, to our aid. This is God going to action, recognizing Abraham's descendants in this covenant relationship. He's remembering it in terms of invoking that relationship. He's saying, I'm going to rescue you. As sure as the covenant I swore to your forefathers, and I will certainly give you the land. Let's keep reading from verse 6. Therefore say to the Israelites, I am Yahweh, and I will bring you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. I will free you from being slaves to them, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with mighty acts of judgment. I will take you as my own people, and I will be your God. Then you will know that I am Yahweh, your God, who brought you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians, and I will bring you to the land I swore with uplifted hand to give to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. I will give it to you as a possession. I am Yahweh. How will God rescue them? God will rescue them. Notice there in verse 6, it's with mighty acts of judgment. The kind of sense of certainty that God spoke with, the other thing we need to kind of see is that he intends to do that through his mighty acts of judgment on his purposes. In judgment is so that people will be rescued from Pharaoh. And it's back there in verse 1 as well. We'll just quickly read that bit. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Now you'll see what I will do to Pharaoh. Because of my mighty hand, he will let them go. Because of my mighty hand, he will drive them out of his country." See, that's God's intention. He's going to rescue his people through judging Egypt. And so God does. Through 10 plagues that devastate Egypt, each plague really kind of upending an aspect of creation. You can go through them in your own time in those chapters there. I think that the one with darkness is most striking for me, because what did God say in the beginning? He said, as his first act of creation, "Let there be light." And it's kind of like he said, no, there won't be any more light, all right, for this particular plague. It's like he's unmaking creation. And each plague as well makes a mockery of some Egyptian deity. It's kind of like saying, well, you got a god that kind of manages kind of light. Ra is the god of the sun. Yeah, well, no, he's not really in control. I've just turned the lights off. All right, you have a god that kind of is a frog, kind of frog-headed god sort of thing. Don't bother praying to him, because he's not in charge of the frogs. Because watch, all the frogs are coming out of the river, the Nile, and they're everywhere now, because I am in charge. Those dreadful plagues, they finished, didn't they, with the terrible plague on the firstborn of the land, where every firstborn died. Unless you followed Moses' instruction, you killed a sacrificial lamb and painted your door frame with its blood. And so the Israelites, they obey. They did so. And in all of that, Moses gave them the festival of Passover, which comes down to us as the Lord's Supper that we celebrate every few months. See, all of this, the angel of death passing over the houses of the Israelites as judgment fell on the Egyptians, that is God at his work, saving through judgment. And of course, in the story, you might remember, but please take the time to read it. Again, Exodus isn't a long read. Those 20-something chapters where the stories kind of they'll probably only take you maybe an hour and a half to read. Pharaoh finally let them go after the plague on the firstborn. But not before he changed his mind. He sent his chariots after them. And yet, once again, God protected his people. He separated them from their pursuers by a cloud. And eventually, they got to that very famous Charlton Heston moment. You know, kind of on that rock there. All right, Moses, with his staff, he parts the Red Sea. No, Charlton Heston didn't do it. Moses didn't do it. God did it. God parts the Red Sea for his people to go across on the dry land. And when the Egyptian chariots try to follow, the gap closed and drowned all of Pharaoh's charioteers. Once again, God saved his people through judging his enemies. And this will be the pattern throughout Yahweh's dealings with Israel, with his people. Whenever Israel was oppressed and called out to Yahweh, he would save them through an act of judgment upon their enemies. But to some, it might look like God is playing favorites with Israel, isn't it? I mean, he's chosen them after all, or chosen Abraham. Is God blindly on the side of Israel despite the innocence of their enemies? So that's the second aspect of this. Firstly, God judges in order to save. I didn't put these sub points in there, but that's the first sub point under point one there. God judges in order to save. The second sub point is God judges because he is just. He is fair. You see, the conquest of the promised land, All right, that's going to happen in a few weeks' time. We're going to come to that part of the Old Testament story. It certainly brings up a lot of feelings for people. It sounds a lot like the ethnic cleansing that happened in parts of Europe and Africa in our living memory. Is God really a fair God when he turfs out the Canaanites, when the Israelites are told to invade and take over? Well, way back in Genesis chapter 15, when God made this covenant with Abraham, I'm not sure if you heard it last week, he gave this time frame when his descendants will inherit the promised land. He said there's going to be a delay of 400 years. Why? You can see it there. Sorry, the one on the back is, the red doesn't really come up. You see in verse 16, it's because the sins of the Amorites have not yet reached its full measure. See, God, he doesn't give the land, the promised land, over to Abram and his wife and his he doesn't have a family at that stage, but his future family, not right there and then, because their sins of idolatry, it hasn't kind of reached this point of no return. Sins of idolatry, worshipping other gods rather than worshipping the one true creator, it's because of that he's judging the Canaanites. It's because of that he's judging the Egyptians, we find out in other parts of the Bible. It's because of that that he judges all the other nations that they come across. This basic idea that they haven't worshipped the Creator, instead worshipped something else. In fact, more often than not, we feel sorry for the people that the Israelites kind of come across and they encounter, and particularly the Canaanites when they are turfed out of Canaan. But more often than not, it's actually Israel that's under the judgment of God. Because God is just. God is fair. He doesn't kind of turn a blind eye to their idolatry. Israel isn't some kind of favorite child that doesn't matter what they do. You know, God's going to kind of just love them by turning a blind eye. See, they too, in their history, turned to idols. And God was more than fair in his judgment, in judging them. And you can find that, and we'll come across that next week in 2 weeks' time when we look at the book of Judges. Now, but after all that, you might still ask, but if God is a loving God, why judge at all? Why can't he just walk past it all and just kind of, you know, live and let live? Let people figure it out. Our feelings like that, and I do have them as I read through the Bible, as I read through stuff in the Old Testament. It actually shows me, though, it's just how far that our culture and our thinking have moved on from the biblical idea of love. Now, what's love? Well, love is to do good to the other, okay? But to do good for the other, you need to know what is good. And to know what is good, it requires a vision of what's ultimately right and wrong, what's ultimately good and evil. So let's backtrack. If God has actually created humanity and all of creation to relate to him, and that was all very good at the beginning, then surely it can't be right for God to leave people in their rebellion and idolatry against him, can it? While we hurt ourselves in our sin and hurt each other? In parenting terms, those of you who have been parents or are parents right now, would you leave your children to just their own devices, unsupervised, so that the older children can do whatever to the younger children? Right, that's called neglect, isn't it? That's when DOCS comes in. Is that what we call them here in Queensland? Yeah, it's Department of Child Services, I think. Because training and discipline must be part of bringing up children. That neglect is when you don't train and discipline your children and to own eventually the values that you have. Sure, that training and discipline must be alongside of tenderness, all right, care and fun, all right? So, yeah, there is some aspect to which it is true that it's good to have fun, all right? But to let children hurt their siblings, that's when you really, really feel it, isn't it? That's when you kind of know in your heart of hearts to love, to properly love, actually involves a degree of judgment, a judgment of other people's actions and they're and disciplining them accordingly. That's how, what our Heavenly Father and Creator is doing in the story of the Old Testament. In a way, he's been a good parent. So God judges because he aims to save. God judges because he is just. And the last sub-point here, God judges because he has to, it's his alien work. So in the story of the Bible, when we get on later on in the Bible, we actually get to a point where we feel that distinctly God is actually sick of having to judge his people. In Isaiah chapter 28, we get the impression that yes, he's judging, but he's being pushed to do it. But he rather not. In fact, it's an alien task for him to do. Have a look at this, Isaiah 28:21. The Lord will rise up as he did at Mount Perazim, and he will rouse himself as in the valley of Gibeon, to do his work, his strange work, and perform his task, his alien task. Now stop your mocking, or your chains will become heavier. The Lord, Yahweh Almighty, has told me of the destruction decreed against this whole land. This is much, much later on in the Old Testament story. The prophet Isaiah, he's prophesying the destruction of the nation of Israel. Precisely because they've become just like the Canaanites they've displaced, worshipping idols, ignoring God, and even actually mocking his word that comes from through his prophets. So those references about God doing those things at Mount Perazim, the Valley of Gibeon, they're kind of a bit like what God has done in Egypt. They're both events in the Old Testament where God had actually protected his people in great displays of power and judgment, where he protected them from his enemies. But now, in verse 21, he's saying now God is going to rise up. He's going to use his power against his people rather than for his people. But you've got to know that this is an alien, it's a strange work, it's an alien task for God to have to do. This is a strange work for him to do in the sense that God is not wired to judge. God is not wired to do this against his people. There's a sense he's an unwilling judge. But he is holy. He is just. So he can't just sweep sin irresponsibly under the carpet. And yet at the same time, despite the rightness of the judgment, God doesn't like doing it. It's not his hobby. All right. It's an alien task. As we work through the Old Testament, indeed the whole Bible, it's really easy to misunderstand God like this because of his role as a judge. To think that somehow God is mean-spirited, he enjoys kind of punishing and beating up on people. He's this kind of cosmic grumpy old man, right? Who's looking for an excuse to be angry with us. Even amongst Christians, you might hear that the God of the Old Testament is the God of wrath and anger. And the God of the New Testament, well, he's the God of love. Now, that's not it at all. It is the one God throughout both Testaments. People reckon that just actually haven't read the Old Testament very well. God will judge sin, sure. His holiness and his perfect sense of justice demands that. But when he judges sin, it's an alien task. He'd rather not do that. He'd much rather bless. In fact, the pattern of all this is that he will bring blessing out of punishment. He will bring salvation out of judgment. And that's the last point we have, the cross. The cross is what we're going to, the greatest act of judgment and salvation. God is so bent on blessing and saving, he will in fact send his own son to enact the greatest act of salvation through judgment. Have a think about Jesus making his way one last time to Jerusalem, knowing full well he's fully man, he's fully God, he knows what's ahead of him, what's going to happen to him, he knows how he's going to be treated, he knows full well that when he gets to Jerusalem, he's going to be betrayed. He's going to be lied about. He's going to be tortured. He's going to be crucified. And yet, what does Jesus do in, say, Luke 19, when he comes over the hill and he sees Jerusalem in the distance? The Bible tells us he weeps. He doesn't want judgment to fall on Jerusalem, despite how he's going to be treated. The alienness of having to judge people is also seen at the cross as well. Because at the cross, God actually takes the judgment and the punishment we deserve. Somehow he takes that into himself. Mysteriously, amazingly, justice was upheld at the cross. The sins of the world was punished right there in the person of God the Son. Sin is punished. But it's such an alien task. He'd rather bear that in himself. As Moses discovers later on in Exodus, God, Yahweh, Father, Son, and Spirit, is truly gracious and compassionate, slow to anger and quick to forgive. So you put it all together, what we've seen about the rightness of God to judge. It gives us this kind of powerful picture of what God is like, isn't it? Yes, he will judge sin. Sure, his holiness and sense of justice demands that, and rightly so. But when he does judge, it's not malicious. It's not over the top. It's right, it's deserved, it fits the crime. And yet despite the rightness, he doesn't enjoy having to do it. It's his alien task. He much, much rather bless. Judgment is a terrible reality because we're all under it, unless we trust in Jesus. But the Bible, especially the book of Revelation, reminds us, though, that evil that has been perpetrated throughout our human history, some of you who are from overseas, you have seen this firsthand. Those of us who have lived most of our lives in this country, we are so blessed that we have not seen institutional unrighteousness and evil and persecution meted out just because it's the will of some arbitrary dictator. See, Revelation tells us, it's written to a group of people, God's people, who have been exterminated by the Roman Empire. Evil that goes unpunished. Well, that is evil if you're in charge of the universe. In the Revelation, the saints of God cry out for judgment from God. Not because of vindictiveness, not because we're better people, we're merely sinners saved by a gracious God, but we want God's name and his will to be done, for justice to reign. Friends, it's also important to get it right in our heads, though, to see that God is bent towards blessing. In the ultimate scheme of things, he judges with a heavy heart. Anyone been bowling lately, lawn bowling? Right, what's wrong with those balls? Right, why do they always curve away from the thing I'm trying to hit? Unless you throw it really, really fast. All right. Well, God is like that. He's always bent towards blessing. He judges with this heavy heart. So we seriously misunderstand God if we don't pay attention to what the Bible says about him. And we can be completely wrong about him if we forget that the God who punishes sin and rebellion ultimately took that punishment upon himself when Jesus goes to the cross to bear the punishment for our sins. Friends, how that works out in terms of talking to your friends about Jesus is that you always have to hold out the gospel first. It's become kind of a bit trending in this Facebook generation to decry the advent, you know, the coming of the kind of same-sex marriage and all those sort of things. The thing, our world is changing so fast, isn't it? I'm only 40, so many changes already happened, right? Those of you, I can't imagine what it'd be like for you if you were in your 60s or 70s or 80s. And it's really, really easy to reach for that sense of frustration with the world and go, God, why can't you just judge all that and bring about justice? What happens with that line of thinking, though, is that it really, really hardens you. It can harden your heart against your neighbours, your friends who don't yet know Jesus. Yes, God judges, but he judges with a heavy heart. He always leans towards blessing. And that's why, as his people, we want to always be holding out the gospel first. That in amongst all the bad news and the terrible things that happen in this world is the great news that Jesus has come to save. Back to where we started in terms of a bit of research, this is other part of the research. What do we do to hold out the gospel properly? What do actually non-Christians appreciate and attract them towards Jesus? Well, funnily enough, the top attractor to Christianity, according to research, is actually for non-Christians to see us, those of us who are Christians, live out a genuine faith. A faith that owns up to the difficult parts of the Bible, right, in the face of the world, not shy away from issues like judgment and hell, and yet demonstrate the love and mercy of God in the way that we live and in our earnest attempts to share the good news of Jesus. Who is God to you? What sort of picture of God have you had in mind as we've gone through the Old Testament so far? Is he a big, cruel bully who just wants to punish and judge? Or can you now appreciate that God weeps over the lost? So much so, he's willing to go to the cross for us. God desperately wants to bless, and our response should be to put our trust in Him. Because through His greatest act of judgment, He has made possible our salvation in Jesus Christ.